We welcome back our friend writer Colin Fleming, whose newest book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, is available everywhere. Colin also doing personal appearances at any stairs in the greater Boston area. Just yell out the word Zulu Warrior and Colin's head will turn.
Pay me and I will climb for you.
I would do that. I would gladly do that. Yes.
I have someone who's been inspired to start climbing, and they're texting me their stair sizes, how many stairs they run. And I have to confess, Kimball, my trash talking is a touch on the macabre. I think it reflects my life. I said to them, you wouldn't want these texts published. I said, if you start to feel chestness, tightness in your chest, don't assume that it's indigestion. The Reaper has his hand on your heart. Like baby aspirin.
Well, that's a form of encouragement, I think.
I want to break, you know, I'm a competitive guy. I want to break the will of people, just suck the spirit out of them, of people who try to compete. Now, the thing is with stairs, it's not like I'm great at stairs. If anyone just does it every day, you get to a certain point, differently with the whole writing thing. So I have to have like a mental edge to my game as well, lest I get surpassed, which I would not handle particularly well.
Well, you know, I saw a picture that you shared a couple of days ago. I think you could intimidate people just by wringing the sweat out of that Bruins cap.
I just hung that. I'm in the bathroom right now because it's the only place like where there's any light. And that Bruins cap and that Hockey East, Beanpot sweatshirt, t-shirt, is freshly hanging and dripping down the bathroom door and giving some nice streaks to the mirror. It's not really a particularly welcome smell to have come. It's like, who's that Peanuts character? Pigpen, the guy with the dirt? I'm the guy with the odor. So, yeah, it's not... I don't know why people love the heat. I really don't. I was writing on the blog about it today. Like, to me, it's the same as having a fever. Who wants to have a fever? It's uncomfortable. I really don't get it.
No, and I'm with you in many ways that I'd rather have winter than this. This is hard to get out there and enjoy at any level. Winter, I can bundle up, breathe the beautiful fresh air. There's not much good about this.
Why do you think people like it so much? Like, even just today, I went out for a second climb of those stairs, and moving my arms just through the air, it's like the air is thick, it's resistant to movement, you sweat so quickly, and that's fine if you're going to work out, but a lot of people aren't, and your skin is hot to the touch. Again, it's like being feverish, like you're on Little House on the Prairie, and you're sick, and the wagon has to pull over for a day. I really don't understand the appeal of it for people. It's so uncomfortable to me.
No, I'm with you. I don't understand it either. But I do understand this. We've got a holiday coming up. It's 4th of July. And this week on our conversation, it's a 4th of July special as we honor some wonderful stories, music, athletes, and more. And let's start with a great song from a band we've been talking a lot about lately, The Grateful Dead. And really the song that brought them to people's attention for the first time on pop radio, AM radio, back in the late 60s, Uncle John's Band.
Probably did. The Grateful Dead in 1970 were largely an inescapable presence. You have this album that came out in summer, in June actually, 1970, Working Man's Dead, and then later at the end of the year, American Beauty. So this is Uncle John's Band kicking off that first album, and as I mentioned to you in our correspondence, it very much has a Yellow Submarine, Round Up the Gang, we're all hanging out sort of vibe to it, and as well as the whole Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band conceit. But I think it also goes deeper. It manages to blend, and this doesn't happen that often. Although I guess you could see it in like sort of some 19th century English poetry. It blends the pastoral with something quite trippy. And you don't get a lot of that. I think that's one of the reasons why something like Rubber Soul was so radical at the time, because it blended English folk with American rhythm and blues. It's not a very common mashup. But this idea of this song with these just delectable harmonies, you have this depth, like we were talking about before, that old, weird Americana. You have a barn dance sort of setup going on with it, too, with the whole notion of a buck dancer special, and a buck dance was when the guys got to pick the ladies they were going to dance with. So it's like a Lady's Choice in reverse, and the idea of this Uncle John and this band he leads and come out and join them. And the band is, it's almost like a magical realism aspect. They're playing to the tides. The tides are the audience. I mean, it's just a delicious concept to me.
And if you listen to it and somebody told you, oh, this is an old Stephen Foster song, you might not be shocked at that, except you'd say, well, I don't think Foster wrote anything this good.
Foster was, it's interesting, because he was sort of like a pioneering pop smith. You can listen to a lot of those Foster compositions, and there's not a huge leap from like Stephen Foster to Elvis's Sun Sessions. So the leap isn't quite what people might think it is. I mean, he really knew his way around tune and a bridge and a chord progression. And I like the idea, too, of, and it's not for show, it's not ostentatious. There's such sincerity in that line. I think it's something that really got to me with the Dead, of what I want to know is, are you kind? It sounds so basic, but it's not. No one would express it that way. And the whole idea of, it explains a large part of their appeal to me, that people actually do for legitimate reasons, because I think you need art. You don't need filibustering on social media. That's not going to be able to win people over legitimately to causes. But art can win someone over to the cause of a better life. I think that's really what this song espouses. And again, the harmonies are, we've talked about this in the past. These guys just, it's amazing to me that more isn't made of their harmony. You hear a lot about the Birds, their harmonies, and certainly the Beach Boys. And the Beach Boys, their harmonies were almost sometimes too perfect, too slick to me, too
right.
Blended. There's like a separation of voices, and yet still that blending of those voices and the Dead's harmonies. Like, I've certainly never heard an American band sing harmonies like they do.
And it's an effortless harmony. It doesn't sound practiced.
No, that's the thing, too. I watched Sons of the Desert last night again, and I was just thinking, like, this is effortless comedy. It takes so little. It's like a flick of the wrist, or like when I'm writing a story, it's like a flick of the wrist to convey something. Their harmonies are like that, because I've listened to all of the sessions that went into the making of this album and this song, and the harmonies were there throughout the entire session. It wasn't like, okay, we're going to have to work on this forever, and this is your part, and of course they screw up and they start again, but they're able to just nail it. And you hear it in live performances, too, like the 50th anniversary of this record. There's a concert from New Jersey in 1971 that concludes with this song. And think about that. You wouldn't expect a Dead show to end with this song, yet when you do think about it, it is the perfect capper to an evening out of the Dead with the Dead in their prime.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Let's continue to discuss music and look at an interesting album from the band at a time, apparently, when they were just not getting along very well and would disagree about everything they did except the music that other people wrote, and they decided to release a cover album called Moondog Matinee.
This strange history of like cover albums in the 1970s, like John Lennon's Rock and Roll. It's sort of like where you go when you're having an artistic midlife crisis, even though you're like, what, 30 or whatever it is at the time. But like artistically, you've kind of done your thing, and now you don't know what your next thing should be. So it's like this holding pattern kind of record. And I thought it was like a great 4th of July sort of session. It's not like a celebrated record by the band. There are really only two of those and some shows on bootleg or whatever from the Hollywood Bowl 1970. There's another good one from 1970 in Pittsburgh. But it's like this low key, just we're kind of jamming. We dig these songs. Let's just do them. Maybe we can get it together again. There is an unlikely cover of Sam Cooke's Change Is Gonna Come, which you wouldn't expect from these guys, really.
Yeah, also an unlikely cover of the Third Man theme.
in the Beatles, they did that, too, during the Get Back session. And it's funny, it kind of speaks to like the ubiquity of the Third Man theme. The Beatles, I'm sure, with no rehearsal, are all just able to like replicate that kind of like Harry Lime pattern, that zither music transcribed to guitars. So that was like certainly in the air, but you'd expect to be more in the air with an English act than well, Canadians for the most part. And so, yeah, it's another surprise, but it just speaks, I think, to the sticking power of that. You just would have encountered that film a lot, I think, at the time, which now is maybe a quaint notion because we can encounter, but we really choose not to, anything of value whenever we like. Like, you and I can both, like, get off the phone later and go watch Third Man whenever we please. But I think this was something that would have been on in homes, and they just would have encountered it. And again, it's a nostalgic record, and it's a way of handling these covers band style. It's funny, too, because when the band was playing Ronnie Hawkins, like, in 1964, they were just this, they weren't this Americana band. They were this tear it up, let's fight with razors, punk, guitar, thrash, really exciting, visceral band. So they always had that kind of, like, discography in them. They had those covers in them. But I feel like when you listen to this album, you wouldn't expect it to be so genteel, necessarily.
Well, check out Moondog Matinee. The title itself, an homage to one of the founders of rock and roll, a radio legend, Alan Freed, who did that Moondog Matinee out of first Cleveland and then WINS in New York.
Yeah, yeah, just one of those voices where, well, he was like the original rock and roll radio voice, right? I mean, I can't think of who else it would be, but him. And then later you had sort of poor man's imitators like Murray the K in New York and stuff like that. But yeah, that idea, that nostalgia, and the idea of the matinee itself. And I mean, do people even, the movie version, do people even go to matinees anymore? Like, I always kind of dug like a matinee and at the Brattle going to see Citizen Kane like in the middle of the day after working hard all week at like 3 o'clock on a Friday type of thing. But again, you're wrapped in that kind of world, that nexus of the throwback as a way to find some momentum to start moving forward again.
We're talking about great American works of art, and an interesting one up next to one of the great horror movies of all time, Creature from the Black Lagoon, which you, I think, correctly point out is a film to which Jaws owes a great deal of inspiration.
Anytime you see those shots in Jaws, which has become a touchstone 4th of July film, I think it's a very slick film. I think that's a problem with almost all of Spielberg's work, excepting E.T., which meant something different to him on a personal level. But anytime you see those shots in Jaws that are kind of looking up from the depths towards the surface of the water, and you see legs dangling, that type of thing, that is straight out of this swampy creature from the Black Lagoon. And it's a film that, was speaking of the heat, every scene in it, it just looks like it's roasting, everything's dripping. It's like, hey, come into the terrarium we call a movie. Like, it's hot. And so then you have these people that are just casually doing whatever they want to the Gill Man's environment. And this was like kind of the last hurrah for Universal Horror, because they have their salad days in the 1930s, especially the early 1930s, when you get Dracula, you get Frankenstein, and then in 1935 you have Bride of Frankenstein, and then also in the early 1940s you have the Wolfman. But then they become these monster rallies, and it's like, oh, look, there's John Carradine and Dracula in this one. And they're all just sort of like roping these characters together in matinee form, see, it's like planning, for like kids. And they're sort of silly in a way, and I think they press a certain nostalgia button now for people who grew up watching those and Creature Double Feature or whatever it is. But this was the last hurrah. This was a really concerted effort to make a strong horror film with sci-fi overtone. So it's a mashup again. In the 1950s, as we know, it was just like this dominant era of the sci-fi film. Most of the great sci-fi films are from this like mid-1950s period.
And this one is so good on so many levels. It's got a wonderful cast. Julie Adams is terrific in it. And one of my favorite character actors from that time period and into the 60s as well, Whit Bissell.
Yeah, Whit Bissell. He's one of those, again, another actor who just shows up on TV and films. And if he's in it, it's usually pretty solid. That's like the worst it's going to be. And don't forget the soundtrack. Because again, the Jaws soundtrack is minimal. It's like just a few notes, or at least that's what we think of as the soundtrack. I mean, there's obviously more to the soundtrack than the famous refrain. But you get a famous, well, maybe not as famous, refrain in Creature from the Black Lagoon. Ta-da! Like, it sounds atonal. And it's like a very unpleasant kind of sound that cues the Gill Man. Or, and I like how they show restraint, just like his hand, his marvelously detailed hand, claw, whatever you wish to call it, just sort of like parring the banks because he wants to he wants to do some hooking up. He's ready to go with the Mirth women.
And it's also one of those movies that I guess maybe going back to King Kong, where the monster becomes in some ways a sympathetic figure.
That's a good way to go. And you also will get it in with like human monsters with at the end of, for instance, Macbeth, when it's like, okay, now I'm kind of pulling for this guy. We're pulling for, once we get around his weirdness, and it's just such an amazing costume. It's just one of the go-to monsters. It's probably the coolest looking monster in the Universal stable. And he never does anything wrong. I mean, I guess the thing that the Gill Man did wrong was he wasn't like killed off when he was presumed to have, his sort was presumed to have gone extinct, and he's still there doing his thing. But I like sort of the echo parable of it too, where it's like, okay, we'll just throw our trash over here, and he doesn't like that. And then when they have like the poison in the water to stun him, and all the dead fish come floating up, and all that stuff, it's just like really ahead of its time. You wouldn't have expected like sort of that scolding of how we behave towards the earth in this film in 1954.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Another terrific work of art from the great Edgar Allan Poe. One of my favorites of his, and one of the great revenge, I don't know, do we call it a revenge fantasy, The Cask of Amontillado?
The narrator in this, he is, which could be a stand-in for Poe with the publishing industry that he was dealing with at the time. And it also, it gives you an idea of how different publishing is now, because this ran in 1846, like the most popular magazine of the day. So Poe's idea of having it bad is like really nothing compared to how publishing is now. But that's like one way to read this story, that it was Poe taking a kind of fantasy-based revenge on his many critics, because people didn't like Poe. They did not think he was worth being in their clubs and partaking of their reindeer games. He was one of these misfits, and he refused to go gently into that particular Eldritch night of his. So it's a story where you get this a lot with Poe's short stories. It's limited in a sense because it's like a one-note kind of story. And it's like this guy really likes wine, and this other guy wants revenge. He's like, oh, I have this awesome wine. Come see it in the cellar. I'm going to totally inter you. And the guy's like, okay, I'll drink the wine. And the wine guy doesn't make a lot of sense, Fortunato, because people who are usually really into wine or spirits or whiskey or something like that, they're not as gluttonous as this guy. Like, they'll even swish it around the mouth and spit it out. But he's like, no, I can drink barrels of this stuff. It's awesome. So you also have the inspiration. This is where it kind of dovetails with the 4th of July. And Poe was stationed in the 1820s at Fort Independence here in Boston, South Boston. People might know it as Castle Island. I walk out there a bunch. I've only done it recently, just one time. But he heard this story when he was there, that there was this like duel on Christmas Day once upon a time with these officers. And a beloved officer was felled for the exact revenge. And the guy who took him out with his rapier, they blurred him and entombed him and all this stuff. None of which was really true, but I guess there was a skeleton found there at one point. That's all he needed to get this concept. And a lot of Poe stories are the concept. They don't go anywhere else beyond the concept. It's just like, oh, that's kind of like a neat gambit. And this is, I think, kind of like his neatest. This and The Telltale Heart and Thump. That kind of deal. It's all about the gambit with Poe.
And with that active narrator, there's no mystery. You don't have to solve anything. You know what happened. So it's really in many ways a character study. And in this one, yeah. As the story develops, you're kind of wondering, I don't know, did what Fortu deserve his fate?
No, you're never told. it's like, so it's either like really not that bad, or it's so bad, like I can't even go into it. It's going to take like another 8,000 words. And Poe is someone who got you in and out pretty quickly. He only has the one novel. He's a short form kind of guy. And I think it's a problem of the story, or at least it is for me. There's no real jeopardy for the narrator. Like, he's, what might happen? You find out at the end that he's like in jail and he got caught. I was like, no, it was like 50 years ago. It rocked. I totally got away with it. He just could be some insane guy. But there's never like any choice involved for him. And like I said, there's never any like jeopardy. It is a character study, as you said. And it's a very like over-the-top, lurid, grand guignol kind of character study. It's not nuanced. And it's interesting because if you look at Poe's criticism, which he wrote so much of and nobody reads, he's very nuanced. But he's not especially nuanced in his fiction, where I feel like he'd be better served with some nuance.
And you wonder what drew him to this idea of, what is it called, immurement, when you imprison someone and they can't get out, because it shows up in a number of stories. Now, I know for me, someone who can get a little claustrophobic at times, it sounds like one of the worst ways to go to me.
It was all the rage at the time, fear about this. It's funny, when you mention that, I'm also that way. I remember one time I was in high school, and it was like this, for my last 2 years of high school, it was an all-boys high school, and we like went into the woods for like these trust exercises. I thought, like, I don't trust any of you bastards. This sucks. I don't want to be doing this. And there was this like tunnel in the earth, in a hill. It was like a cement sort of like tunnel, like a tube. And you were supposed to, you crawled through it. Everyone crawled through it, and like you could barely fit. I thought, like, well, this sucks. I don't want to ever do this again. Then they're like, okay, now one person get on one side, one person get on the other side. You pass each other in the middle. I'm like, hell no.
No way. No.
I'm thinking about Poe. I'm thinking like, no, this is not, it's not happening. So I feel like even my whole stair climbing thing started with not wanting to be in elevators with people. I don't trust them. I don't trust the people. I don't trust the elevators. I'm free on the stairs. Like if the building starts to go down, I can still make a break for it. Be quick, like the Flash. So I totally hear you.
Finally, let's talk baseball and All-American seasons. And, well, first of all, what's your definition of an All-American season?
I thought that would be cool to have that sort of open for interpretation, but almost like that sort of like collegiate All-American, like the big man on campus that ties together themes that we think of as distinctly American. So if we're talking just players to go first, like Mickey Mantle, 1956. New York Yankees, Triple Crown, All-American Golden Boy from Commerce, Oklahoma, and the jawline. It's just like an All-American kind of season. Like, you think of it that way. Mantle's like this All-American. And you don't have to be like an American to have an All-American like season, but just to stand out that way. And what were some of the other ones I mentioned? Like, obviously, you have like Maris in 61, and the home run record meaning so much. I still think it's kind of like the most vaunted record there's ever been. And I don't think anyone really looks at Sosa or McGuire or Barry Bonds. Like, you still think 61 and the M&M boys, that was such an All-American kind of season by Roger Maris. Maybe your man, Mr. Yastrzemski, in 1967, right? Oh. Because it's Boston.
Absolutely.
So it's like All-American, but well, did all this stuff here.
Well, I would
so
go
back. You have to have.
I would go with back to back, maybe because that's the age where I really became aware and a fan of baseball. But Yaz in 67, winning the Triple Crown, improbable pennant for the Red Sox. And then on the other side, maybe not the most All American figure, but he sort of captured the time in 1968. Denny McClain winning 31 games and getting the Tigers to the World Series.
And I think you have to be in a kind of town or city. Like a Philadelphia or New York, like it wouldn't really work as well for like Arizona,
right,
or
right.
The Seattle Mariners. You need that kind of like that. You need to have had a franchise, been on a franchise that was around. So like with Yastrzemski, you also have the whole idea of Boston and the scrappy underdog. Like it's very revolutionary, colonial war sort of like that impossible dream season. So I think that that's one for a player that. It really stands out to me, but I think for me personally, the All-American season player-wise is Ted Williams in 1946. Because baseball, it was like the beginning of the 1987 NFL season when you have all these guys, like these replacement players. That's what a lot of baseball was, and like Hal Newhouser winning like the MVP
right.
in the mid-40s. Like it's a little sort of like watered, or a lot watered down.
Right, the St. Louis Browns winning the pennant.
And baseball was, it was just the biggest thing back then. It was bigger than the NFL is right now. It was, so you get these guys like Ted Williams, Stan Musial, coming back from the war, serving their country in this, not just a war, like a skirmish, but like a world war. Like that's just such a huge deal. And then the attendance was booming, and you have the Red Sox, and Williams wins the MVP. He doesn't lead in batting average, home runs, or RBI. In two seasons where he wins the Triple Crown, he doesn't get the MVP because he was hated so much by the writers. He could have pulled the Poe and interred someone in the ground after luring them with wine, probably. But it just seemed like so all-American. And Williams, I think, his heroics on a grander scale than that of a ball field, I think they speak for themselves.
And you also talked about some great all-American seasons for teams. And I think you've highlighted one of the very best, and that's the Brooklyn Dodgers, the perennial wait-till-next-year team who finally got it done in 1955.
Them bums, yes. And I think you have teams like the teams have identity. So they used to, the 1959 Go-Go White Sox, the 1950 Philadelphia Whiz Kids, the Murderers Row Yankees of 27. I think the 2013 Red Sox are a good one, too, because of everything that happened in Boston that year.
Right.
At the marathon. But
and you mentioned the 79 Pirates, too, the whole Stargell and We Are Family thing. That was great.
Stargell was like, behold, I shall win every MVP this year. he's the co-MVP of the league, Keith Hernandez, which maybe should get Hernandez into the Hall of Fame. He's the NLCS MVP. He's the World Series MVP. And he's sort of like a little bit better version of Kirk Gibson in 1988 for the Dodgers, who would be another good team, another good choice. But the We Are Family Pirates are great, and they're fun, and it's disco into the 70s and all of that. But I think the thing about the 55 Dodgers is you have the sport. It's integrated. So Jackie Robinson's still there. He's not a star anymore, but he's still there. And you have Roy Campanella, who is a major star. You have Duke Snider. And I think you can't overstate for people what that whole idea of Willie, Mickey, and the Duke meant in New York.
Right.
Arguments the kids had on schoolyard playgrounds about that. Sandy Koufax is a not very effective rookie. And you have the Yankees taking these guys out every year. They're the Buffalo Bills of baseball. And it's beloved. And I think another thing with a team like this, you have to play somewhere cool. Like the 87 Twins, as I mentioned, they're a really cool team. Worst the First, and Ken Herbeck and Kirby Puckett, great player, and all of that stuff. But they're playing in this mall. The Dodgers of 55, they're playing in Brooklyn. They're at Ebbets Field. And they have all of these sort of melting pot themes going on with the integration of the team. You have an All-American type of shortstop in the great Pee Wee Reese, who I think is just criminally underrated, a fantastic player, and a guy who helped with Jackie Robinson's transition into that league.
Right.
So they would be the team for me.
Yeah, I would not disagree with you on that. And even a young Vin Scully at the microphone for those games.
Isn't that crazy? Like sometimes like math is depressing and wary. Other times you look at math, and I think on the blog I was writing like Connie Mack. So Connie Mack is my age.
And yeah, what did you say he had like 42 years?
He had 42 years left. Like he was ready to go. Like he was just kind of like getting going at that point. I mean, he had won what he was going to win with this like Jimmy Fox and Mickey Cochran teams and all that. But like 40, so that's like happy math. Vin Scully is a guy who, he provides happy math in your life. And also, another thing, too, you can't underestimate this. The baseball cards. Do you know what the baseball cards of the 1955 top set look like? Because I think that's part of it, too. They're these paintings, six cards, and they're just like, they're just lodged in your brain. Like the Koufax rookie from that year, Campen. Like, it all looks so classy and artful. And yeah, I think that's just like kind of the quintessential sort of baseball memory, probably for a lot of old-timers now from that area.
No, I would agree. Absolutely. And I'm reasonably certain that with your Zulu work ethic, you've got at least another 42 years of great writing ahead of you.
So he made it to 87, and I need to be a triple digit guy. Well, like Kimball, when I get something like chili peppers, because I've read that they're good for the heart, I'm a man looking at 100, not for like a happy reason, but because it has sucked so much to date that if it doesn't suck, I am going to just lord it. Oh, I'm going to be so obnoxious and lord it over people if I get to where I should get to.
I'm going to buy you a coffee. We'll get together. I'll buy you a coffee on your 100th birthday.
like Ghost Kimball?
Oh,
your ectoplasm is going to like ooze into, well, hopefully I'll be like having multiple homes at that point, but like you're going to ooze in and be like, hey, remember when you came on the show? I was like, hey, Bangor.
Dude, you're not the only immortal at this party. I'm going to be right there with you.
You live on in tape, my friend. I'll play you loud and clear.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Colin Fleming, check out Meathead Say the Realest Things. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog. Go to Colin's website at colinflemminglit.com. Colin, happy 4th to you, and we'll check in with you again next week.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming, every Tuesday on Downtown.